From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
It's very hard for crossbenchers to get into the House of Representatives, but when they do, these small players can be difficult to blast out. Two crossbenchers who've managed to dig in and hold their seats are Cathy McGowan, who's the member for Indi, and Rebecca Sharkey, who's the member for Mayo. Research conducted by the University of Canberra in their electorates found high praise for these crossbenchers' independence and their connection to their communities. Rebecca and Cathy join us today to discuss the popularity of community candidates, the standing of Parliament, the issue of women in politics, and other matters. Cathy, let's start with you. At the weekend, we've seen in New South Wales in the by-election in Wagga Wagga, the Liberal Party lose a seat that they'd held for more than six decades. It's gone to an independent, Joe McGirr. Do you see this as another example of a new mood in the community, one where people are willing and anxious to embrace crossbenchers?
So huge congratulations to the people of Wagga Wagga on what they've done. I do see it as a mood, but it's a bit like Gabby Chan says in her book, Rusted Off. The system's got to be a bit broke before the community will do it. So clearly there were things happening in the Wagga Wagga area that the people were really cross about. The previous member of parliament left under bad circumstances, the National Party didn't run, and the man who actually won the seat had run before and he was well known and he had a really good reputation. So I think, as Gabby said, you can do it, you've got to be organised, you've got to have community support, and the community have got to trust you. But it doesn't happen unless the system's got a crack in it.
Rebecca, what do you think it takes for crossbenchers who are successful in the House of Representatives to be embraced in the longer term by their electorate?
Well, just in the short term, just to get up and to win a seat is incredibly difficult for an independent, for a crossbencher, because ultimately, you know, elections need money, and that's the one thing that independents normally don't have. What we were able to do, I think, in the first instance was gather support from the community, because if you don't have money, you need people. But to sustain it, I think, as an independent, you have to always remain true to your community.
Now, you had special circumstances. You won initially as part of the Nick Xenophon team. You're in the successor party to the Nick Xenophon team after it changed its name. But nevertheless, by the time you faced the by-election a while ago, the Xenophon factor had faded, and yet you still did very well.
Yes, I did, which I'm eternally grateful to my community for. But I knew that I had a very limited time between winning in the first instance, and when I won in 2016, people said, oh, you only won because of Jamie Briggs and events in Hong Kong. Oh, you only won before of Nick Xenophon. So I knew I actually had to then prove myself to my community that giving me a chance was the right thing to do for us. So I'd like to think that on this instance I won somewhat on my own merits, at least a good portion of that.
Cathy, do you think this trend to independents winning seats from major parties, and at the moment it's not in the House a big trend, a big phenomenon, but do you see it as a way of the future, especially in the regions?
And I absolutely do. And there's something really interesting happening in my area of northeast Victoria. We've got the Victorian election, which is due at the end of November. And Michelle, something really fascinating is happening. I've got four state seats. In the seat of Bunambra, a young woman is running as an independent. She's under 30. In the southern part of the electorate at Eildon, another woman is running as an independent. She'd be in her late 30s, early 40s. And I haven't heard it definitely yet, but in the Murray Valley electorate, there's another woman who's going to be running. So in three of the four state electorates in my neck of the woods. So it's not only, and whether or not they get up, I don't think it's going to be the issue. The fact that they feel there's a good role model, they know how to do stuff, they're encouraged, and there's a really strong community that's saying, go for it. Go for you as a woman, go for you it as an independent, and we want to see more of, I'm going to say, the Cathy model, the Rebecca model, there, and we'll get behind you. So, and I say to these young women, it's actually not about winning in this instance. Getting there, learn your skills, learn how to run a campaign, learn how to fundraise, learn how to think about policy, and you can run in a whole lot of other elections in the coming up. But 3 out of 4, just in my electorate, it's just, so something really is going on there.
Now, Rebecca, you two are centrist candidates, basically, centrist MPs, rather different from the phenomenon we see in the Senate, where quite a number of the crossbenchers are at the edge of politics, as it were, leaving aside the Greens, of course, on the left, but at the right edge of politics. How do you see these two phenomena?
Well, often we're lumped together and we are poles apart. I mean, I think for a House of Representatives seat, you really, as an independent, you really do need to be sitting somewhere in the middle, because you need to get enough of the primary vote in order to then get up. And that's where most of Australia sits. I mean, that's why sometimes we have Liberal in, sometimes we have Labor in. Then up in the Senate, of course, they don't need as much of a percentage to get across the line. And that's where people, I think, also in the Senate do like to do somewhat of a protest vote. But I think you could certainly say, with respect to Andrew Wilkie, Cathy or I, people are not voting for us out of protest. They're voting for us because I'd like to think that they see a reflection of their values within us that they're not seeing from the major party candidates in our seats.
Now, we've got the date now for the Wentworth by-election, October the 20th. Do you think this is likely to be another opportunity for a strong independent to come through? We expect that Karen Phelps, who's well known as a doctor in the area, former president of the AMA, high profile in the marriage equality issue, do you think that she would have a strong chance, and would either of you be willing to lend her a hand?
Look, I think Professor Karen Phelps has an excellent chance if she wants to put her hand up for it. Look, it's a huge task, commitment to take on. I think she would be a fantastic Member of Parliament. I would certainly be very keen to support her in any capacity, and that just might be, phone calls just to give her some support, because elections are a brutal business. But I think if she can muster the community, muster volunteers, because you absolutely need that, and some a little bit of funding to help get her name out there, because while we know her, and it's the same, I think, for every independent that runs, people are not switched on and engaged in politics as much as we are, as I guess you could say, political junkies. I noticed that in the by-election for my community. Now, the posters were everywhere. It was constantly in the newspaper, and then even the morning of the election, people were saying, what do you mean there's an election on today? Do I have to vote somewhere? Mm. Getting out there and getting cut through in the community is a challenge for an independent.
They might be a bit more switched on when their man, who happened to be the Prime Minister, was just deposed, but I think the...
You'd hope so.
..the wider point holds. Cathy, what do you think of fellow crossbenchers campaigning for each other? Rebecca had that in the by-election. Have you had that? I think you have.
So it's an interesting thing, because I certainly campaigned for Rebecca on her second election. I didn't know her on a first, but I felt I could go with great confidence to the people of Mayo and say, I know her, she's done an excellent job, she's a very good representative, and she's across public policy. I could say that with confidence. The other thing I could value add to the discussion is Rebecca was in a similar situation to me, in that the Liberals ran a really vicious campaign against me in 2016, very personal and very, very negative. And so I wanted the people of Mayo to know, if that happened to Rebecca, it wasn't personal about Rebecca, it's just what they did. And so I was able to take across some of the big posters that had horrible photos of me, really terrible photos of Bill Shorten. They were nasty and they were black and they were wicked, saying, Cathy votes green and red. So I took them to Mayo and said, this will happen to Rebecca. When it does, it doesn't actually mean anything about Rebecca. So please be aware that it's a technique that they use. Don't take it seriously. So I felt what I was doing was actually talking to the people of Mayo about what I knew about Rebecca. And then she could value add to that and use her own experience to sell herself. But I thought I was helping them in their management of their decision-making, providing information that they wouldn't have access to otherwise.
And they certainly did do those posters in the by-election, but I think it's important for crossbenchers to say, look, I don't always vote the same as my fellow crossbenchers, but I think it's important to have diversity in the parliament. And I think that's where we recognise the value of each other as well.
Rebecca, I have to ask you, what was it like when Bob Katter arrived saying, I'm here to help?
Look, I was grateful for Bob Katter's help. Certainly, I think, you know, Bob Katter and I have had a very clear difference since the by-election around his position with respect to Fraser Anning. I've got to say I was quite disappointed in his comments and also Fraser Anning's comments as well. But look, for me, this is about ensuring that we have as much diversity as we possibly can on the crossbench, and I would relish the thought that we have a future member for Wentworth on the crossbench.
Now, you talk about the rather tough, very tough targeting that you've experienced, but what is it like here in this building when you're trying to transact business with government? I do notice that when you ask questions, the Prime Minister, whoever, and the ministers are very polite. I mean, they know the crossbenchers potentially have a lot of power, so you are treated quite well in the House. But what's it like behind closed doors?
So it's Cathy here, and I'll start with that one. It reminds me of negotiating with my mother when I was a teenager and I wanted to go out at night, and she was very reluctant and she'd say, well, go and talk to your father. And I got very good at doing it. So, but what I'm saying is it's got a sense of it that's really important and you take it really seriously, because every decision that you make, you have to be able to go back to your community and say, here, I did this. But at the same time, we are both principle-based people. So I go back to my community and I'm saying, here's the principles that I work from. And staying true to those takes a lot of discipline, because one of my principles is I don't do deals. I say to the government, you've absolutely got to do good governance. So I'm not going to do a deal with you for my vote. So today, for example, I asked the Prime Minister a question about the future for energy policy. Now, I'm not going to hold him against the wall and say, you do what I want or I'll withdraw my vote. I say to him, good governance says that this nation needs good energy policy. And I'm representing my community and I'm saying to you that it's important in my community. Now, I'm not going to make you do it, but I'm just letting you know that here's your opportunity as good government to do it. And he might say, well, if I don't do it, so what? And I say, well, if you don't do it, my electorate will vote against you. And many other electorates, because I'm sure I'm not Robinson Crusoe here, many other electorates in rural and regional Australia want good governance around policy. So it sort of works that I'm actually a gift to the government. If they actually would listen to it and take our advice on board, they could save themselves a lot of trouble. So sometimes they do. Sometimes they seek out our advice and listen to us. And sometimes they smile at us nicely and say, well, not tonight, Cathy.
And what's your experience, Rebecca?
I have, I guess, the added responsibility, but also the added opportunity of having two Senate crossbenchers. And I, for legislation around education or social services or agriculture, I carry any legislation through both houses. So I go and I'll be sitting in their chamber in the advisors' boxes when key legislation goes through that relates to my portfolio. Look, at times you get wins and you have good dialogue with government, and you actually, I think the best thing is when you put up private members' bills and then and then you negotiate with the minister and they see value in some of your points, and then they take it on into their own government legislation. For me, I always work on evidence-based policy, evidence for legislation, and I think if you always keep, for me, if I keep around that as my focus rather than it being left or right or what is populist, I think you then stay true to yourself and what your community values.
But if I could just come in again, it's Cathy here, is that you wouldn't want to be an independent on the crossbench if you were scared of making decisions. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't work if you weren't able to stand up for yourself and have a really good debate around what's going to be best for the nation. Mm-hmm. So it's no place for shrinking violets. And I have to say my negotiation skills and my understanding of getting to yes have improved out of sight in the 5 years that I've been here.
Now, if Wentworth is won by an independent, the government is in a minority position in the House. This doesn't mean the opposition could get up a no-confidence motion, but it might try one on. Can either of you see any circumstances under which you might support a no-confidence motion?
Well, it's Rebecca here. I might go first on this. I have given to Prime Minister Morrison confidence until the Wentworth by-election, and for me that is an opportunity for me to observe in the Parliament but my community to observe at large how the Scott Morrison government operates. And from that point, obviously I'll be taking thought from my community about how they think this is going. There is still a lot of grieving in Mayo for the loss of Malcolm Turnbull. And I think that we're giving this new government time to you know, get their feet under the table and actually prove to the Australian community that they are there and they are effective at government.
What do they say about this loss?
Well, my feeling is that people feel that they had a vested interest in who the Prime Minister was, and that we have had the loss of so many prime ministers. And I think coming from a more conservative electorate, they were more upset about losing Malcolm Turnbull than perhaps they were about Gillard or Rudd, because that was their prime minister. And that largely, I think, is because we have presidential-style elections. So people think that they actually do vote for a prime minister, even though we all know under the Westminster system that you vote for your local electorate representative. So there is still, I think, a lot of feeling of loss there. There was a lot of relief that it was Morrison and not Dutton, but still there is a lot of grief for the loss of Turnbull.
Cathy, what was the feeling in Indi?
Very similar, except that there was another level. That one of the things that Malcolm Turnbull and I had in common, and we spoke regularly about, was this energy policy, because even though he had so many difficulties with it, he was committed to getting energy policy through. And in my electorate, there's an enormous amount of community-based work happening around community energy. And so every single time I met Malcolm Turnbull, he would ask how it was going, what's the community doing. He encouraged, supported Josh Frydenberg to come when he was minister, to come and check out what Yarkandandah was doing. So there was we knew that he was interested in us, and we knew he wanted an NEEG. And he and I had talked regularly all through the negotiations about the NEEG, that when it came up, would he get the support of the crossbench? And I'd said, yes, we're working on it. We work on it together. So to have done all that work and have the NEEG go down when it's such an important issue in my electorate. So it's the personality, but it's the loss of policy positions. And then to have the Prime Minister today say that he's still going to agree to Paris, so that's really important. But I will still continue to talk to him and his energy ministers around, we need, if we're not going to have the NEEG, you can't just have a vacuum. You've got to, for the next election, you've got to go with some clear policy.
In those discussions, when he was concerned about how the crossbench might behave, did you get any perception of a fear that he couldn't carry the party? His own party?
We didn't go there, no. No, certainly that wasn't part of the whole conversation. And we never did talk about party politics. We'd keep focused on the electorate, on what Indi was happening, and where the policy was impacting on our electorate. So I don't know about Rebecca, but certainly I keep very disciplined in my meetings with ministers about what I need. Here's my agenda. We're not doing any deals. We want good governance. And here's how it works. So what's your government doing around these topics that are really important for us?
Just going back to the confidence question, can you, Cathy, see any circumstance in which you might support a no-confidence motion?
Well, it's a bit... I'm not in a position to say at the moment. I'm very much like Rebecca. Let's wait and see what happens in Wentworth, and then we'll revisit all the discussions again. But I suppose it's probably important to say that my community's preference is that the government sees out its term. 4 years was what we wanted them to do, get their act together, govern and get out of our lives. But there is a strong, a bit like Rebecca was saying, there's certainly a section of my community who are over it. sent emails, Kathy, just get rid of them. They're a waste of time. We don't want them there. But I don't think that's the majority. I think the majority just want the government to go full term. They're having an election in Victoria. Let's get that out of the way. Let's have an election as late as we can in May. And then by then, this, if this government has settled down, we'll consider it. And I think there's a hope that they will, the hope that we'll have good government, and that we won't just constantly have political bickering happening, that we'll actually do substantive work. So that's what my community is asking. And I'm not yet in a position to, a bit like Rebecca says, that we've only had 3 days. Gosh, let's give them a bit of a chance to see how they settle down and then see what Wentworth does. We'll reconsider the decision then.
Have either of you set up any arrangement with either the Prime Minister, the new Prime Minister, or the Prime Minister's office for regular consultations, briefings, times that you can bring up things, or is it ad hoc? Rebecca?
Well, for me, it's ad hoc. I tend to go to the respective ministers in relation, you know, whoever's portfolio I'm particularly focused on at a time or perhaps legislation I'm concerned with. So, for instance, just last night I met with Ken White, the Minister for Ageing, because that is an area of particular interest that I'm working on at the moment. But the Prime Minister has said that his door is open. I will say for Malcolm Turnbull, when he was Prime Minister, whenever I picked up the phone and said, I need to meet with you to discuss an issue, the door was open.
And what about you, Kathy?
And mine's more formal. So I've had regular meetings with the Prime Minister, met him on Monday, and will continue to do so. I have also got relationships with his Chief of Staff and also Josh Frydenberg in the same way, and have, like Rebecca, excellent access to all the ministers. They give us great attention. And also our staffs do a lot of work with Chief of Staffs and other people. So it was once said to me, if you're in the crossbench, you'll never get anything done. And you should vote for a party because then you can talk to the minister. Well, that's been the furthest thing from the truth. I find that this government is extraordinarily accessible, as is the opposition, and have very close relationships in terms of professional relationships with the front bench. So it's really a fantastic position to be in on the crossbench, because you don't actually have to worry about party politics and who you can and can't talk to. You actually have got access to everybody.
And when a government has a one-seat majority, it would be even better than if they had a 15-seat majority, I would have thought.
Well, it certainly was in the 44th Parliament. I also had excellent access when Tony Abbott was there in the early days of Malcolm. So, well, in a way it has changed. The access has always been there. And I think it's because there's a moral high ground which comes with the crossbench. The ministers actually want your support, so they bother to give you a briefing. And even if they're not going to agree with you, or we're not going to agree with them, they like to think that we've understood the issue from their perspective.
Now, Peter Dutton is under pressure on a number of fronts, but one issue is whether he breaches the pecuniary interest section of Section 44 of the Constitution. Rebecca, you've been down this path on another part of that section, the citizenship section. Do you think Peter Dutton should be referred to the High Court to clear this up?
So I added my name to a motion last year because I was quite prepared to test my case with the other, I think, 8 cases at the time in the High Court. As it was, it went to a tie and the Speaker voted it down. I think with respect to Peter Dutton's case, I think that that should be tested by the High Court. One thing that I've learnt from the whole of Section 44 is that what your legal counsel says is often quite different to what the High Court then rules. And I think that we need some clarity around this particular issue.
Do you think he should be referred, Kathy?
Absolutely. I think it should be done quickly and efficiently and effectively and sorted out. And I think it's taking up a huge amount of space in Parliament at the moment. I wish we could get it done to the High Court.
And both of you would vote for that?
Yes.
Do you think that Section 44 should be put to a referendum and fixed up?
Well, I mean, look, it could go to a referendum. What we do know, though, is referendums are notoriously difficult to get up. Whether we just have enough High Court judgments around any issues of ambiguity, that may be the way forward. I don't think that there's a huge appetite in the community to have a referendum on this issue. I think that there's a feeling that we've wasted a huge amount of the 45th Parliament time on Section 44. I think the best thing from this point forward is for Peter Dutton to actually refer himself to the High Court.
I'd like to turn to your feelings and observations on the debate about women in politics. Cathy, what do you make of the rowing that's been going on in the Liberal Party about this?
There's two levels to work at. I've already talked about what's happening in my electorate with all these women standing, so I think there is another way we could do politics. My overall observation is what's happening in the Liberal Party is it's massive disruption, and that's probably a good thing. And
About women, or more generally?
The whole thing is not working well. And certainly the women is part of it, their leadership's part of it, their ability to do numbers is part of it, their ability to work for the national good is part of it, their esprit de corps is part of it. There's a whole lot of problems in there. So I think that needs to be dealt with. And in the dealing with it, I wish them the wisdom that Joan Kerner had in the Labor Party. It was Joan Kerner's work who realised that things would need to be different, and in solving the problems that the Labor Party then had with women, they were able to address a whole lot of other issues that have actually given them a much stronger party now. So I think it's the problem with the men and what's going on in the party mostly, because there's so few women there, needs to be addressed. And I think if they can find a much better way of managing their own conflict, and it's not just the bullying, it's how they work together as a team, that the end result could make for a much better party, and I wish them well. And in making themselves a much better party, they might actually open themselves to greater diversity and to better systems and practices for managing conflict.
If I could just follow up on this, as we know, a number of them made allegations about bullying. Cathy, if it had been you who'd made the speeches they did, would you have followed through and named the bullies? They have retreated.
Oh, I'm not in a position to answer that, because I'm never going to be part of a party and never going to be part of the enormous pressure that the parties bring on their members to conform to a...
But just walk in their shoes for a moment.
Well, I can't. I just can't do it. And the other thing about bullies is, for me, in my life, I was bullied on the school bus. And I can remember going home and saying to my mum, what do I do about it? And my mum said, well, you need to go and address it. So for a whole stack of my life, whenever I came across bullies, I learned how to manage it. And part of the managing was to sort it out at one level, to bring in authority when you needed to bring in the law when you needed to do written complaints when you needed to, and get it addressed. So how you do that, I think everybody actually has their own way of managing it. But I'm extraordinarily sad for those women who are still in the Liberal Party and have given up their voice for themselves to be part of the party. I just think that's a huge cost to pay. But they've been prepared to pay for it, and they make their decisions that obviously there's a bigger benefit for them being in the party than speaking out. And for me, I would never make that compromise. I think being an independent, being able to speak for myself and for my community on issues that are really important is what makes me an effective politician. So I hold to that really strongly.
Rebecca, do you think that federal politics is difficult for women?
Well, that's difficult to say, because for me... I've found that my team is extraordinarily supportive. I might actually just touch on the issues Cathy raised. I think the Liberal Party needs to look in the mirror and look at the culture and actually accept that they need to change, because that's the challenge at the moment. Is I don't think that there are enough of them that see that they actually have an issue and that they need to very quickly change their policies around how they pre-select women, and that they need to pre-select women in safe seats. Now, that needs to happen federally, but also if I look at my state of South Australia, we at the recent election back in March, we had, I think, four safe Liberal seats where members were retiring. One of them was held by a woman. Four men were then pre-selected for those four Liberal safe seats. So this is an issue that is widespread in the Liberal Party, and if they want to be representing half of the nation, they need to ensure that that representation is also reflected within the parliament.
So you're saying quotas? They need quotas, the Liberals?
I think they do. I think that they've gone backwards since John Howard's time. So they need to to have, you know, a sharp U-turn, but also they need greater diversity. When I worked for the Liberal Party for 6 years until 2012, and at the time there were a couple of people who said, look, you know, you really should put your name forward. I went and spoke to somebody high up and they said, look, you're a single mum. I really don't think it's going to work for you. So you know, at that point I thought, well, there goes any political career for me. And I walked and went into a completely different industry. And it was only through, you know, dumb luck or chance that Nick Xenophon said, look, you know, I think you'd be great as a Member of Parliament. And here I am today. But I did work for 6 years for the Liberal Party, and that was what was said of me. So if they're not going to look at women differently, they won't change.
I want to just turn finally to the culture of the Parliament, not just for women, but the culture generally. I've recently spoke to a community group who'd been to Question Time that day, and they were absolutely appalled at what they'd seen. I just want each of you to reflect on the culture, and Cathy, you've put forward a motion about standards of general political behaviour. I think perhaps you can tell us also where that's up to.
So we've put forward a motion for a code of conduct, and we're what they call socialising it, because it's going to need broad support to get there. We're not there just yet, but there's certainly discussion happening about that.
And that covers what sort of things?
Well, it's a process to come with. It's beginning with what would be the process if we were going to have a code of conduct. So we haven't even quite got to the what it would actually cover, whether it would be principles-based, would it be like the code of conduct for the ministers, or how it would work. So we haven't quite got to that stage yet. But I have a lot of visitors to my parliamentary office, and trying to explain to them how Parliament works, here's a bit of the metaphor, and I sometimes feel a bit of a wimp about justifying it, but I say to my people from Victoria, I love football and I love a grand final, and Parliament's a bit like two teams heading off. So you can't expect them to be nice to each other. They're playing for a grand final and they've got their captains and whatever. But sometimes I say, rather than being the elite sport that AFL is, it's more like rugby. And they all laugh because no Victorians like rugby because it's so rough and it's tumble and it's so New South Wales. But I think it's if people actually understand that it's an elite sport, people practice it, it's not like going to school. So if you're thinking you're going to come to a maths class, you're not going to get it. You're actually going to be more like a sports drama class where people are performing and acting. So none of that explains the lack of respect. None of that explains the lack of logic that I would like to see there. But I just can't work out what to be done differently. And when I did talk to Malcolm Turnbull about this in one of our discussions, he actually did have a preference for the English model of how they did it. But I don't think he just never had the space to actually introduce
it. Do you mean the English model that ministers appear on particular days, they don't all appear all the time?
And questions are about a topic.
Right.
Right, and the Prime Minister has one day for questions. We don't have the all-up brawl that we often see in Question Time.
I'd like to add to that I think we could do better in Question Time. I know they say, look, it's theatre and it's there to be enjoyed, but when I look at the school children in the gallery, I think that we could approach Question Time differently. I think certainly the crossbench question is always the question that calms down the House. One thing I would like to see removed are the Dorothy Dixes, the questions from the
backbench. Or better written,
backbench.
At least.
Oh. And my understanding is in the UK Parliament that they actually do ask you know, important questions rather than these Dorothy Dixes, because I tune out for them and I think half the population does too.
But leaving Question Time aside, culture in this place is quite extraordinarily good on most things. So I know people do judge Question Time because it's the public place, but the matter of public importance today was a very solid debate about an ICAC. The debate we're having on modern slavery is very respectful, very good, very strong. And the debate we've had, the debate and then the committee work, I'm on a couple of committees that are extraordinarily well run, do really productive work and come up with really good ways for the nation. So I want to say to people listening to the podcast, don't just tune into Question Time, tune into some of the committee work, tune into the debates, tune into the adjournments. And if you really got time, Monday morning, private members' business is some of the best work that you'll hear. It's current, it reflects diversity of opinion, and it's real debate around real issues.
On that optimistic note, we'll end. Kathy McGowan, Rebecca Sharkey, thanks so much for talking with us today. That's all from our podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Burlage. We'll be back with another interview soon. Goodbye for today.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.